Very good. Mr. Howard didn't tie the recorder wire all up in knots like I did for him. I want to talk to you about an important subject today, about prophecy. Prophecy, you've probably heard it many times, is history written in advance. History written in advance. We've been told that perhaps one third of the Bible is prophecy. A lot of people don't realize that. And that perhaps 90% of the prophecy is yet to be fulfilled. And one of the proofs of God is prophecy. And when we can look back on these fulfilled prophecies and see that they came to pass, we realize that there's a great God, the God of the Bible, that inspired these words and made it happen. Proof that God exists and proof that the Holy Bible is His Word. So it's good to go through prophecy and look at it. This will tie in a little bit with the Bible study that we started covering on the mark of the beast, the Middle East and prophecy. When was the last time you read the booklet? If you're like me, it may have been quite a while. Have you ever read the booklet? It's really important. There's a lot of information in here. Don't let it get you down or get you confused. You're going to have to go back to the booklet in your Bible and study it again, because it's very detailed prophecies. Also, another good thing to listen to, there was a sermon given on Daniel's prophecy, which covered Daniel 11, the Middle Eastern prophecy, by Richard Armstrong, June 4th, 1954. Excellent sermon on it. He said it was written around 538 BC, when it started to come to pass a little over 100 years later. And to go along with that, it seems that this prophecy is the longest prophecy recorded in the Bible and covers a span whenever it's completed in our end time, around 2300 to 2400 years. So it covers a long, long area. So like I said, don't let it get you bogged down or as you hear all these funny sounding names. And none of you may have kept up with boxing in the past years, but George Foreman, I think he was a world champion boxer at one time for a while, he named all of his sons, I think there's three or four of them, he named them George. Well, some of these people keep having the same name, they just put a one, two, three, or four or whatnot after it. So remember that too. But it's very interesting. Let's see what I did with the booklet here. Let's hope I didn't throw it away before I got up here. Oh, here it is. We're in luck. But it talks about the Middle East. A lot's going on over in the Middle East, even though right now, there for a while, Ukraine was all in the news, wasn't it? Now you don't hear that much about it on your TV news. Now you're hearing about abortion and stuff, about the Roe versus Wade decision, handing this back down to the states and for people to vote on it. But our eyes are distracted from the Middle East. In the Middle East, is ceasing with crises after crises. Few people realize the true significance of this turmoil. They seem to have no conception of the danger it threatens, eventual danger to the whole world. Many people don't know that. They might would think the danger had come from somewhere else. It's time we woke up to the facts. It's time we knew what prophecy reveals. It's time we knew the background, the vital factors that have led up to the world danger, the significance of this series of crises. There's only one way to know the answer. The God who made the world, who made and unmakes nations, He reveals the future before it happens so we can know and take warning. And we need to review that now. It's probably been a long time for some of you since you've looked into this. It says, going back to a prophecy that foretold 2,500 years ago, this very series of crises and the war that shall finally draw in all the nations of the world. That's how important it is. The whole world is going to be drawn into World War III. It is one of the most amazing prophecies in the Bible. And like I say, we go verse by verse and then go to the history book and see how it was fulfilled in history, how God brought it to pass. And that's pretty amazing. If our faith might be shaken, well, does God really exist? Is the Bible really His Word? If we just go to these scriptures in the Bible and see how they were fulfilled, it will build our faith back. If our faith is a little shaken, we'll be able to say, you know, right here, if this great God could predict these things a couple thousand years in advance and it happens, I'm in good hands. Now, I'd like to look and see, of course, this vision came from God, but want to see who came and told Daniel about these things. Hold your place here in Daniel 11, but flip over to Daniel 9, and let's read verse 21. Yes, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, reached me about the time of the evening offering. He is one of the three evident top angels that are mentioned by name in the Bible. Of course, Lucifer, Satan, the devil, Michael, and Gabriel. In chapter 10, verse 1, this happened in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. A message was revealed to Daniel. The message was true, but the appointed time was long, and he understood the message and had understanding of the vision. Now, if we'll go over to chapter 11. Also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I better turn the time on. It looks like we'll get extra time today. Also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. It says, actually, there were 12 more kings in the Persian Empire, but only the first four following Cyrus were of importance for the purpose of this prophecy. There was Cambyses, Pseudosmerdus, Darius, and Xerxes. It was the last, or Xerxes, who was the richest of all and stirred up war with Greece. So it says, verse 3, then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided towards the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. So what's that verse talking about, those couple verses? It's talking about then King Philip of Macedonia, as we read earlier, Xerxes, who was the richest of all and stirred up war with Greece. As we went through about the four beasts and everything, we realized that the third was the Greco-Macedonian Empire. Yet it says, then King Philip of Macedonia planned a great war to conquer the Persian Empire with an army made up mostly of Grecians, but he died before the plans were completed. But his son Alexander the Great took over his plans. So that is interesting. I've heard said that Alexander may have been about 20 years old whenever he took over his father's kingdom. And he went out to conquer the world, 20 years old. So he met the Persian army. Alexander the Great took over his plans and invaded Persia. He met the Persian army at the Battle of Issus in 333 BC. Let's hold your place there, but let's turn over to Daniel, the 8th chapter. Daniel 8, let's look at verse 2. I saw in the vision, and it so happened while I was looking, that I was in Shushan the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Eul. and verses 5 and 6. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. So you see, this is explaining about Alexander attacking the Persian Empire. Then he swept down into Egypt and into a final crushing defeat of the Persian Empire at the Battle of Arbela in 331 BC, after which Alexander marched on a conquest clear to India, sweeping all before him. So Alexander took all that area over there. From what I've read, it took Egypt, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Macedonia, Greece, of course, where he was from, Judea, the Palestine area, North Africa, Lebanon, Syria. So that was a chunk of territory. It was an empire, the Greco-Macedonian Empire. He went all the way to Egypt, they said. And how old was he? He is an old man of 33 when he died, from what I understand, of drunkenness. Only 33 years old. I think I heard someone say he broke down and cried. There was nothing left to conquer. But they said that they even in modern times studied Alexander the Great's techniques of warfare. I was told, and I didn't realize that, you've seen these war movies of the old times and they have these big catapults that hurl the stones at the wall to break it down. They said Alexander the Great came up with that. But he died. So once he died, let me see here how far we went down here on the verses. And it says, and when he has risen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided towards the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. They say he wasn't married. He did have at least one illegitimate child, but of course, as this prophecy says, the kingdom would not go to him. Who did it go to? It says it was divided up four ways to the winds. So, how marvelously and how accurately this came to pass. We quote from one of the authoritative English language histories published in the last century, A Manual of Ancient History, student series by Rawlinson. I understand that you can't get these, that they're unavailable. I'd like to check online just to see if, just like much literature, if it maybe it's been posted online. It'd be interesting to read from where he's quoting here. Cut off unexpectedly in the vigor of early manhood, the 33 year of his age, June 323 BC. He, Alexander, left no inheritor, neither of his power or of his projects, page 237. So can you imagine that? It came to pass just like the scripture said there in the Bible, that there'd be this leader that would come up and take over and conquer the Persian Empire. And then how it also showed that he would not have a living relative take over his kingdom, that it would be divided to the four winds. And the generals did that. The generals did that. The empire was left leaderless and in confusion, but out of this emerged by the year 301 BC. So you can see it was a few years there. What about, looks like what, 22 years? Four divisions, just as prophesied. Just like the Bible said there, the Persian Empire, then Alexander's empire conquering everything, would then be divided into four sections. And it went to his generals. Ptolemy Soter ruling Egypt, part of Syria and Judea. Seleucus Nicator ruling Syria, Babylonia, and territory east to India. Lysimachus, and I'm probably mispronouncing some of these good names, ruling Asia Minor, and Cassander, ruling Greece and Macedonia. Thus was the prophecy of verse 4 fulfilled to the letter. So think about that. This was written, I think he said, 100 years or so before, whenever these prophecies started coming to pass of Daniel. So it wasn't something Daniel just looked at, something happened in his time, and then wrote it down. No, because as we go through these prophecies, we're going to see it covers a span of perhaps 2400 years or so, a long time. This was a prophecy of verse 4 fulfilled to the letter. Now notice what follows. From here, the prophecy foretells the activities only of two of these four divisions. So just think, we're cutting it in half. We only have to cover two of these divisions. From here, the prophecy foretells activities of only two of these four divisions. Egypt, called the king of the south, because it is south of Jerusalem. So that's, if you know that, that Jerusalem is the focal point, then you know the king of the south would have to be south of Jerusalem, and that the king of the north would have to be north of Jerusalem. By the way, the Bible gives its directions. In the Syrian kingdom, the king of the north, just north of Judea, it is because the Holy Land passed back and forth between these two divisions, and because the different wars were principally over possession of Judea, that the prophecy is concerned with them. So here it is, one great big struggle back and forth. You can see that what's called the Holy Land, Palestine, area where Israel and Judah was, that it was just a bloody area. Let's look at verse 5 now. Also the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes. So the king of the south will become strong, and notice, in one of his princes. And he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. So what happened in history is, we learn that the original Ptolemy the First, that's the leader of the king of the south of Egypt, called Soter, became strong and powerful, developing Egypt beyond the greatest dreams of Alexander. So Egypt was a powerhouse, and it was developed. It was the king of the south. One of his princes. Isn't that the way it is in government? Whenever you aren't watching, then you always have to watch out that somebody underneath you wants to take your spot or take something from you, with this human nature influenced by Satan. So one of his princes or generals, by the name of Seleucus Nicator, also became strong and powerful. And now in 312 BC, taking advantage of Ptolemy's being tied up in a war, he established himself in Syria and assumed the diadem as king. So here you now have these two rivals, a king of the north, a king of the south, and they both want the prize. They want Palestine. They want Judea. That's around 312 BC. See, Ptolemy was being tied up in a war, so he wasn't able to watch closely what was going on, and his general took advantage of this. Now let's read verse 6 of this prophecy. And at the end of some years, they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of her authority. And neither he nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. A lot of times throughout history back then, how do you end a war? How do you try to have good relations, a marriage between the two families? So this is what happened. It was a marriage union. The king of the, it says, and in the end of years they shall join themselves together for the king's daughter of the south. So notice it was the king's daughters of the south that went and got married. She'll come to the king of the north to make an agreement. Margin says right, or equitable conditions, or marriage union. But she shall not retain the power of the arm that we just read. Fulfilled to the letter. At the end of 50 years, this occurred exactly as described. Syria's ruler, the king of the north at this time, was Antiochus II. I told you have to go back to the booklet, didn't I? There's a lot here. But we're seeing here in history how each one of these verses are being fulfilled. They were fulfilled, showing again that there is a great God in the universe. And if he can work out all these details like that, he can take care of us in our lifetime. Just like Mr. Vaughn, I think, in a recent sermon brought out that God named King Cyrus nearly a couple hundred years before he was born, told what he was going to do, had his name in the Bible, he went and done it, and then I heard the Jews, hey, look at this, you're written in the book, a prophecy about you. God brings it up to pass. Nothing is too hard for God. So again, going back to Rawlinson's history, it's amazing that you can see a history book pointing these things out and how that it fulfills the very scriptures of the Bible we're going through. That God kept his word. Says Rawlinson, history, oh, up above that first, the prophecy says, he that begat her, that would be the father, right? The king of the south, shall be given up. Also that she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall the king of the north whom she married stand. All three are to come to their end. Notice how accurately this came to pass. Now in Rawlinson's history, pages 251 and 252, on the death of Philadelphus, he that begat her, that was her father, the king of the south. B.C. 247, Antiochus repudiated Bernice. So the king of the north already had a wife. His name was Bernice, but he got rid of her. He kicked her to the curb. I don't know if this other woman was a newer model or what, but he went ahead and married this woman from the king of the south. Antiochus repudiated Bernice. Okay, that's the daughter from the south. And took back his former wife, Laodice, L-A-O-D-I-C-E. So she made it back. She made it back. However doubtful of his constancy, so she probably figured, you know, if he did this before, he could do it again. So she had a plan. Who, however doubtful of his constancy, murdered him to secure the throne for her son, Seleucus II. See, I told you they keep having these same names over and over and just putting numbers after them. One account says that she poisoned him. And then she didn't stop there, but Bernice was also put to death. So you can see how they all came to their end. Nowhere in all the Bible is there so literal a prophecy, given so many details of future history. And to read an ancient history of these kingdoms is simply to see unfolded before your eyes, step by step, verse by verse, this marvelous prophecy. There can be no doubt of its right application. It's amazing. It's really great whenever you can see a prophecy and you can go to history and see how that God fulfilled it. Now let's read verse 7. But from a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place. So a branch of, Bernice's roots. One shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army. He'll enter the fortress of the king of the north and deal with them and prevail. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes. In their precious articles of silver and gold, he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So it says here, but out of the branch of her root shall stand up in his state margin in his office. And he shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against him and prevail. Now out of a branch or shoot of her roots, her parents were the roots. Hence this must be her brother, who next should occupy the throne of king of the south. So her brother was then the king of the south. He went, took revenge, attacked the king of the north, and won, and you can see all the treasures he brought back to Egypt. Now listen to this accurate fulfillment quoted word for word from the same page of Rawlinson's work. Ptolemy Euergetes, that's the brother of Bernice, that's the third, the eldest son of Philadelphus. Again, you just keep having these names pop up over and over, just putting numerals after them. Page 272, and therefore Bernice's brother, a branch of her roots, invaded Syria in BC 245 to avenge the murder of his sister Bernice. In the war which followed, he carried everything before him. And we read there in verse 8, all the plunder that he took. So we read here that he would carry captives and vessels of silver and gold in Egypt, and continue to reign more years than the king of the north, who at that time was Seleucus II. So don't let all these things get you confused or bogged down. Just later on, when you have time, just go through the booklet and slowly absorb it. And he shall return into Egypt. As verse 7 said, he should enter into the fortress of the king of the north. Ptolemy III did seize the fortress of Syria, Seleucia, the port of Antioch, capital of the kingdom. Then he carried back to Egypt immense booty and 2,500 molten images and idolatrous vessels, which in 526 BC, Cambyses had carried away from Egypt. So they went down and they carried all the gods of Egypt back to the king of the north. Then they wanted their gods back. They carried them back to the south, but those gods didn't do them any good, even though there were maybe 2,500 of them. That was in 526 BC, whenever they took them away, which in 526, Cambyses had carried away from Egypt. He continued to rule until 222 BC, while the king of the north, Seleucus II, died in 226 BC. So it's this constant tug and pull of the king of the north, the king of the south, like two dogs after the same bone. Maybe one dog will get it and go bury it in the yard, another dog will sniff it out and go out there and bury it back up. It's mine. And it's just this tug and pull back and forth. So when he died, he had two sons that took over the kingdom of the north. Another Seleucus. This one's the third. He only reigned 3 years. He didn't make it very long, 226 to 223 BC, who ruled only 3 years, and then his brother Antiochus III, called the Great. And we've heard of him, haven't we? Now, he ruled quite a bit longer, from about 223 to 187 BC. Both of these two sons, Seleucus II, assembled immense forces to war against Egypt, to avenge their father and recover their port and their fortress, Seleucia. It's kind of like what here we always hear about the Hatfields and the McCoys, an ongoing battle that seems to be has no end. And they just keep going at it, back and forth. And this was accurately prophesied in verse 10. Verse 10 says, however, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through, and he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife, or to be stirred up again. Verse 11, and the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of the enemy. Antiochus the Great, after 27 years, recovered the fortress of Seleucia. And he also conquered the territory of Syria as far as Gaza, including Judea. But the young Egyptian king, now Ptolemy IV, Philopater, was roused and with an army of 20,000 inflicted severe defeat on Antiochus the Great. And I heard that occurred at Raphia. Philopater defeats the king of the north, fulfilling verse 12, he killed tens of thousands. sometimes we don't think of armies, or some people may not think of armies in way back then as being large armies, but you can see they were large armies at times. And again, annexed Judea to Egypt, but he was not strengthened, for he made a rash and speedy peace with Antiochus. So many people, once you know they win a war or something, they want the other person to pay for it. They want to strip them of all their material wealth. They want to just drain them. They want to get everything they can. But he gave in too easy. He made a rash and speedy peace with Antiochus in return to dissipation, throwing away the fruits of victory. Verse 12 says, of Daniel 11, when he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. But he shall not be strengthened by it. Verse 13, for the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. Sometimes we've heard of our former president saying, they say about him, if somebody hits him, he's going to hit them maybe twice as hard. So here they go back and forth, warring. And shall certainly come to an end of some years with a great army and much equipment. So this verse 13, the king of the north shall return, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and will certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. It was after certain years, or 12 years later. It was 12 years. He built up, he got ready, he planned. 205 BC, that Ptolemy Philopater died. So whenever this king of the south died, he has left his throne to an infant son. That's not good. Ptolemy Epiphanes. Then Antiochus assembled a greater army and won great victories. So he took advantage of the weakness of Egypt, a weakness of their leadership, and he went in. Then he made a treaty, allying Philip of Macedonia with him and others against Egypt. And they wrested Phoenicia and southern Syria from the king of the south. So again, it's a land grab, just like, isn't it, in war after war? Hitler and them, they wanted more living space, more living room. You look at the war between Russia and Ukraine, what does he want? He wants more living space. He wants more land. In this, they were assisted by some of the Jews. Even the Jews got in on this deal. Josephus' Jewish history says many Jews helped Antiochus. But notice how accurately Almighty God had foretold this hundreds of years before it happened. And let's read about that in verse 14. Now in those times many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. Let's read verses 15 and 16 now. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. The glorious land, of course, refers to Judea, the Holy Land. Antiochus the Great besieged and took Sidon from Egypt. He ruined the interest of Egypt and Judea at the Battle of Mount Panium in 198 BC. And then Antiochus took possession of Judea. Again, Judea was just swapped back and forth between these superpowers. And as we look at this and go through this, part of the bad thing is that the Jews, since we realized Judaism, they developed over a period of time the religion of Judaism, which we've been hearing so much about. They fell under, you know, the influence of these conquering people going back and forth and wandered further and further away from God's word. Verse 17, he also shall set his face to enter with the strength of the whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. As we read through some of these scriptures, we wonder, what's all this about? Luckily, God gave Mr. Armstrong wisdom and insight and showed him how these prophecies, we can see what it's, how it's being fulfilled through history, to see what did happen. It says, upright ones, see the margin, in Hebrew means equal conditions or marriage. But the one he marries will not stand on his side. So in 198 BC, Antiochus arranged, this is the king of the north, he arranged a marriage, just like they had done earlier, only I think it was the opposite, between his daughter, Cleopatra. We've all heard of Cleopatra, but this is a different Cleopatra. It's not the Cleopatra of 31 BC in Egypt. This is 198 BC. So Antiochus' daughter, Cleopatra, and young Ptolemy Epiphanes, the king of the south, by which he hoped subtly to gain complete possession of Egypt, but the plan failed. So he hoped that his daughter would support him. Take that little, that strongest part of a woman's body, she can take that little finger and do that and just lead a man anywhere, huh? But she didn't go along with the plan. But the plan failed. Says Rawlinson on page 254, Cole, C-O-E-L-E, Syria, and Palestine promised us a dowry. But it was not delivered. How many times people make promises? You may, between states, they make promises, you do this, I'll do this, but then they break their promises. Their word's no good. It's like an old elderly woman that used to ride with us. She says, these promises like this are like pie crust. They're made to be broken. They didn't mean to keep them. It was just that Cleopatra did not truly stand on the side of Antiochus, for it was only a trick to gain possession of Egypt. See, he wanted to get his daughter down there and take over the king of the south. Verse 18. After this he shall turn his face to the coastlands, and shall take many. But a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end. And with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. So Antiochus, this king of the north, turned his attention in another direction and tried to conquer from 197 to 196 BC the islands and coasts of Asia Minor. But now there's another player on the scene, but the Roman general Lucius Cornelius Scipio Asiaticus. A lot of names. I'm glad they weren't my parents. It's until what I've been called. He utterly defeated him at the Battle of Magnesia in 190 BC. So now we see another player entering in on the picture, the Roman Empire, the Roman general. Verse 19, then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Antiochus next turned his attention to the fortresses of his own land. He suffered defeat. And in the east and west, the attempting to recruit his dissipated wealth by the plunder of the Oriental Temple of Belus in Elamis. He was killed in 187 BC. Verse 20. So you can see there, stumble and fall and not be found. He was killed. Verse 20, there shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. They say that is actually not quite translated correctly. that should be that he would send a tax collector. He would send a tax collector. So Seleucus IV, Philopater, from 187 to 176, his son, in an effort to raise money, sent a tax collector, Heliodorus, through Judea. But he reigned only 11 years when Heliodorus poisoned him. You see why kings and presidents and everyone, at times we've heard, will have someone taste their food before they eat it. Verse 21, and in his place shall rise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. His son, Seleucus IV, Philopater, 187 to 176, his son, in an effort to raise money, sent a tax collector. Okay, we read that, but he only reigned 11 years and he was poisoned. So, verse 21, one would arise, a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. He left no heir, but his brother, a younger son of Antiochus the Great, named Epiphanes, Antiochus IV, a contemptible reprobate, came by surprise and through flattery took the kingdom. Sounds like a real politician, doesn't it? To his aid came his assistant, Eumenes. Rawlinson says on page 255, Antiochus Epiphanes, assisted by Eumenes, drives out Heliodorus, and obtains the throne. In B.C. 176, he astonishes his subject by an affectation of Roman manners and good nature profuseness, flattery. People may say flattery will get you nowhere. In this world, with human nature, influenced by Satan nature, a lot of times it does. I've even been surprised in the church, you know, just looking at people trying to flatter the minister, hoping to get a position. Talking about way back in worldwide days, they wanted to be a deacon or something. Verse 22. With the force of a flood they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. Now, this is interesting because it says prince of the covenant. This does not refer to Jesus Christ, this prince of the covenant. This was an attempt of Antiochus to replace the Jewish high priest by another who would be subservient to him. Isn't that what religious leaders, like ancient king of Israel, whenever he set up his, he had to get rid of the true religious leaders, those who would stand up for God's laws and put people in that were unqualified and should not be there. So Onias was put in. Let's see, the high priest Onias was replaced by Jason, and then later on by Menelaus. So that's the way this world works, isn't it? They try to get control of religion, and then religion then makes the people do what the leader wants. Verse 23 and 24. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. We can see that in our own country. Whenever someone's running for office, they promise you everything. But when they get in there, they forget what they promised. They don't do what they promised so many times. For he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. Verse 24, he shall enter peaceably even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. So although only a few were with him at first, yet by this Roman manner, by deceit and flattery, he crept into power and prospered. He also invaded Galilee and Lower Egypt. His fathers, the former kings of Syria, had favored the Jews. But, says Rawlinson on page 255, They were driven to desperation by the mad project of this self-willed monarch. Verse 25, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. So what happened? Rawlinson, pages 255 and 256, says, threatened with war by the ministers of Ptolemy Philometor, now king of the south, who claims Coel in Syria and Palestine as the dowry of Cleopatra, the late queen mother, Antiochus marches against Egypt. It's interesting how people always say, even like we see in today, we see one country saying, you know, you're on my land. That was originally my land. You got to let me have it back. So he marches against Egypt. That's BC 171. But he was met by his nephew, Ptolemy Philometor, king of the south, with another immense army. But the Egyptian king was defeated through the treachery of his own officers and was outwitted by Antiochus. So what does the enemy try to do? He tries to infiltrate. He tries to get into your government. He tries to get in among those who are supposed to be loyal to you and then tries to get them to turn on you. Verse 26 and 27. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. So notice they get together, have a big feast, maybe call each other buddy, and, oh, you know, we're the best of friends, and they're lying. They're deceitful. They're trying to get something. Continuing Rawlinson's, after his victory at Pelusium, Antiochus advanced to Memphis, and having obtained possession of the young king's person, Ptolemy Philometor, king of the south, he endeavored to use him as a tool for effecting the entire reduction of the country. In 174 BC, the uncle of the king of the south sat at a banquet. Antiochus pretended to ally himself with the young Ptolemy against his brother, Eugetes II, but each was trying to deceive the other. They weren't honest. They were each trying to get control. Verse 28, while returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant. So he shall do damage and return to his own land. So verse 28, 168 BC, returning from Egypt with great plunder, Antiochus set himself against the Jews, massacred many. So no, and it's happened that way even in the church. If they get involved in politics in the past, then the sword has come down upon the church. God doesn't want us to be any part of this world's politics. We aren't Republicans or Democrats or independents. We're servants of God. We're ambassadors of Jesus Christ. And then returned to Antioch with golden vessels from the temple at Jerusalem. Notice he plundered God's temple. Verse 29. At the appointed time he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. The same year he again invaded Egypt, but with none of his former success, because Philometor, king of the south, got help from Rome. Here we see Rome coming into the picture again. For ships from Cyprus, verse 30, shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsook the Holy Covenant. And haven't we always heard the story that guys had a bad day at work or a fight with his wife or something, and he goes and kicks the dog. Here he's been defeated, he's angry, so he wants to take it out on the Jews. So the Roman fleet came against Antiochus, verse 30, and he was forced to surrender to the terms of Popilius, commander of the Roman fleet, and retire from Egypt and restore Cyprus to Egypt. Returning through Judea, smarting under the defeat, he vented his exasperation against the Jews and extended special favor to those Jews who had turned from their religion. So as he was there pouring out his wrath on the Jews, if any of them would give up their religion, if they would follow him, then they would get special favors against the Jews and extend special favors to those Jews who would turn from their religion. Verse 31, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifice and place there the abomination of desolation. So at 160 BC, the next year, came the climax of the horror. Antiochus sent troops to the Holy Land, who desecrated the temple and sanctuary. Notice what he did. He desecrated the temple and the sanctuary. I think I'd read somewhere that he sacrificed swine's flesh or blood or something like that on the altar. Unclean meats. And he abolished the daily sacrifice. Keep your place here, but turn back to Daniel 8. And let's look at verses 11 and 24. And it says, he even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And I think I said verse 24. Yeah, verse 24. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. So I've got here it written in Kislev, the 15th of the Hebrew calendar. He placed the abomination, an image on the altar in the temple. I think they said it, thought it was the image of Zeus or Jupiter. Something like that. Precincts making it desolate. Rollins, page 255. Many who claim to teach the Bible try to apply this prophecy of this verse to the Muslims in the 7th century AD, building the Dome of the Rock on the supposed site of the ancient temple at Jerusalem. But every verse of this prophecy, step by step, verse by verse, unfolded in actual history. We've just read it. Just as here recounted, so there can be not the slightest shadow of a doubt as to this abomination that makes desolate. It was an idol set up in 167 BC by Antiochus Epiphanes. That was back then, of course. We know as we get further in the booklet that there's going to, or in other prophecies, that there's going to be abomination that makes desolate surrounding there at Jerusalem. And Mr. Armstrong seemed to come to the understanding that there may not be a temple in Jerusalem and there may not be an idol set in that temple if there's no temple. He said, what makes Jerusalem desolate is the armies. The armies gathered around Jerusalem that make it desolate. And of course, this was set up by Antiochus Epiphanes in 167 BC. Verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. Antiochus tried to end the religion of the Jews. He took away the daily sacrifice. He forbade the ministration of the temple. He perverted by flatteries the Jews who are willing to forsake their religion. If you'll take a bribe, if you'll do what I want, I'll give you money, I'll give you a position. But right here, the prophecy cuts off from the continuation of events in the history. It says right here, it cuts off. Of those ancient north and south kingdoms, up to this point, the prophecy was unfolded step by step. in the actual history of the northern kingdom of the Seleucidae or Syria, the king of the north, Syria, and the southern kingdom of Egypt, the king of the south. But say most commentaries, all accurate details seem suddenly to stop short with this verse. Then when we were pointing all these things out in the history book, it says, now it seems like it's not working anymore. Let us notice verse 32. Let's read it. And those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. We read that a minute ago. So, but now notice the last part of the verse. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. So our question now is, when beginning with and following after the date of 167 BC, did people begin to know God? How long after that when people began to know God and to be spiritually strong and to do exploits in the Lord's service? The answer is at the time of the Maccabees, beginning 166 BC, and 2 centuries later at their first appearing of Jesus Christ in the days of the apostle. Verse 33, in those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword, inflamed by captivity and plundering. Jesus and the apostles did instruct many, but Jesus was put to death, and history indicates that all of the early apostles were martyred except for John. And this continued many days, even into the Middle Ages, when millions were martyred for their faith. Verse 34, now when they shall fall and shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join them with intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. So now, here is described in general the whole course of God's people from the days of Christ to the present. From the days of Jesus Christ to the present. And we've read history, we've heard about the Inquisition and how that many of God's people have been martyred. We read there in Revelation how, you know, there's this vision like people, the souls underneath the altar crying out, oh Lord God, how long before you judge because of this wicked system that has martyred us? And he tells them to wait a little while, that another great martyrdom is coming. Let's look at Revelation, keep your place marked here, but let's look at Revelation 12:6. Revelation 12, verse 6, then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. Now, if I remember right, that's around 554 to the up to the Battle of Waterloo, Napoleon. But of course, they were being martyred long before that too. And also, verse 11, and they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death. 13 through 17. Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Where the other was 1,260 days or years, a day for a year principle, a year for a day. Over here is talking about in our near future, about the little flock going to a place of safety, a place of final training, a place of nourishment, a place of protection. And Satan the devil is going to be angry. He wants to stop us. He's going to spew out this water, this flood, these armies that try to cause her to be carried away by the flood, but God intervenes. The earth opens up its mouth and swallows it. But there's some people that will not go to the place of safety. There'll be members of God's church that's going to have to go through this time of Jacob's trouble, through the time of the great tribulation. So we want to stay close to God, be counted worthy to escape these things, to be able to go to that place of final training. We want to stick close to God. Notice the vision carries on down to this present time to the end. So we're really moving rapidly now to the time of the end. Now let's go back to Daniel 11, verse 36. Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the god of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall exalt himself above all of them. In 65 BC, Syria was swallowed up by the Roman Empire and became a Roman province. The Roman Emperor now controls Judea, and therefore the King of the North has been referred to at this time the Emperor of the Roman Empire. So see, it shifts. The King of the North is now the Roman Empire. This verse says he should do according to his will, and he did. He exalted himself, magnified himself above every god, and he did, for the Roman emperors required all to worship them and sacrifice to them as a god. He was as a god. He was to speak against the true God, and he did. And he persecuted Christians. We read there in verse 37 how his fathers had worshipped idols, but the Roman emperors set themselves up as gods. Verse 38, but in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses, and a god which his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. The Roman emperor honored the god of forces, margin, munitions, and developed the greatest war-making power the world ever knew, and a god whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. After setting themselves up as gods before AD 476, emperors who followed, beginning with Justinian in AD 554, began to honor with gold and silver and power a god in a high religious office, never known to their fathers. Hold your place there, and let's look at Revelation 17. Verses 4 and 5. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. On her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. In chapter 18 of Revelation, verses 3 and 16, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxuries. Verse 16, and saying, alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. Verse 39, thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance his glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. The emperor did acknowledge the supremacy of religion, increased it with material glory, and caused it to rule over many. Prophecy skips to the present. We've gone through a lot of time. Now we've gone through, it looks like, over 2,000 years of history. Verse 40 says, now we come to the very present century, at the time this was written. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through, or pass over. So it says here, who is today the king of the south? It cannot be the king of Egypt, for in 31 BC, Egypt became a province of the Roman Empire, the king of the north. It was swallowed up by the king of the north. Today, Egypt is a republic ruled by native Arabs. It has no king of its own. But in the reign of Ptolemy III, Euergetes, verse 7, from 247 to 222 BC, Egypt annexed part of Ethiopia, immediately south of Egypt. Rawlinson, pages 272 and 273, since that time, the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica says, article Ethiopia, Egypt and Ethiopia were two or three times under the same government. See, they were the same government two or three times, Egypt and Ethiopia. Thus, the two were as one land, and the only portion of that land of the king of the south that remained independent until the 20th century is Ethiopia. So now we have the Roman Empire, the king of the north, and now we have here at this particular junction, Ethiopia, the king of the south. Ethiopia was the only country in all East Africa that continued independent and had a government and kingdom dating back before the Roman Empire. It was the southern part of the kingdom of the south, so it was the only possible government that could be the king of the south. Now, at the end, our time, this king of the south was to push at the king of the north. He's going to push at Rome, Ethiopia. In 1895, King Menelik of Ethiopia sent an army of 9,000 to 10,000 men against General, Barateria, B-A-R-A-T-I-E-R-I, Barateria's Italian army. North of Ethiopia was Eritrea, belonging to Italy, and southeast was Italian Somaliland. In 1896, General Barateri, with 13,000 men, tried to defend Eritrea against the Ethiopians. They lost 4,600 whites, 3,000 native troops, and more than 3,500 were taken prisoner. So the king of the north got a licking. In a later engagement, the Italians were cut to pieces because of their inexperience in fighting in mountainous country and because they were greatly outnumbered. This defeat was disastrous to the Italian expansion in Africa. Ever since Italy demanded revenge in 1927, Mussolini set the time. In just 40 years from that defeat, or 1935, when he would be ready finally to make our voice heard and see our rights recognized. So that was Mussolini's speech to his people, to make our voice heard and see our rights recognized. 1935 came, the hour struck. Mussolini attacked. Now notice verse 40. And we read that. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass over. A whirlwind comes from the air, sweeping all before it. Mussolini did send a great air force into Africa, also many modern chariots, trucks, tanks, etc., and ships loaded with soldiers. More than 100,000 sailed to Ethiopia. And notice that Mussolini's forces were to pass over in the air. It is at this precise point in this astounding prophecy that Mussolini's struggle in Ethiopia and in World War II ended. Mussolini did not finish the prophecy. There is yet another leader to arise in Europe. Notice what will happen. See, all this is fulfilled history we've been looking at. But now it's got more prophecy that hasn't happened yet. Something in our, probably our lifetimes. I certainly hope so, because it looks like the perfect storm is on the horizon. It looks like so many things are happening to our country in this world. It looks like it's time. But we'll see. We'll see. Verse 41. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. So as we've been told before, I think that's over around Jordan. Mr. Armstrong was friends of King Hussein, I think it was. And he says, guess what's over there in that area? Petra. And Mr. Armstrong says, the Bible doesn't say the place the final training is Petra, but he says, if it's not there, there's no other indication of any other place. The only thing that we can look at and try to think is maybe it'll be Petra. But whether it is or not, it doesn't matter. God will protect us. He will take care of us from this terrible time that's coming. He shall enter into the glorious land, the Holy Land, that is yet to be fulfilled. When the coming revival of the Roman Empire, this United States of Europe we see forming, this King of the North, this beast power, takes the Holy Land, then the nations will be plunged into the initial phase of the great last and final crisis at the close of this age. Other prophecies reveal that the revival of the Roman Empire will bring into subjection the U.S. and Britain. Continue on in verse 41. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. And we read that, but they shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Verse 42, and he shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power, verse 43, over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. This is still future. Many countries will be overthrown, but they shall escape out of his hand, even Edom, Moab, the chief of the children of Ammon, the modern land of the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. The coming dictator will unite many others with him, 10 in all. That's the 10 toes of Nebuchadnezzar's vision. Reviving the ancient Roman Empire. Verse 42 says, Egypt shall not escape, proving Egypt is not now the king of the south. Verse 43 says, the Libyans and Ethiopians observe that after its conquest by Mussolini, Ethiopia is not again referred to as the king of the south, shall be at his steps, and he will then control them. He'll conquer them. Italy lost control of Libya and Ethiopia after the war. Verse 44, but news out of the east and out of the north, Russia and the Orient, shall trouble the revived Roman Empire. Russia will enter the war. Verse 45, the coming Roman Empire shall establish its palace as capital of the revived Roman Empire, and eventually its religious headquarters at Jerusalem. Zechariah 14:2 says, the city shall be taken, yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. That beast power. This language signifies the end of the beast and the false prophet at the hand of God. And you'll find this described in Revelation 19, verses 19 and 20, the return of Christ, and Zechariah 14:12. And now what is the time of this end at the close of this marvelous prophecy? The next verse, let's read Daniel 12, verse 1. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. He says, at the time of the resurrection of the just, at the second coming of Jesus Christ. He says, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation. Even at that time, and at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall wake, some to everlasting life. Yes, when Jesus Christ returns, we know it's the time of the resurrection of the saints, and those of us living will be changed to spirit life. This prophecy begins with the kingdom of Syria in Egypt soon after the death of Alexander the Great, 2,300 years ago. Now, it's been a while since this book's been written. It may be a little over that. But it ends at the time of the resurrection and the second coming of Christ to bring peace at last to the region and to the entire world. It is so plain there can be no doubt of its right application. Are you ready for that event? It is fast approaching. Now is the time to get ready. For Jesus said, "Be you also ready."